Allow me to set the scene. It's Friday, July 18th, 1969, and we are on a small island just off of Martha's Vineyard called Chappaquiddick Island. The plan tonight is to attend a cookout hosted in part by none other than famed Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. Sounds pretty dreamy, right? Well, unfortunately, this night is about to turn deadly and result in the mysterious death of a 28-year-old woman named Mary Jo Kopechne.
She's Sarah.
She's Harley, and we're gaveling in another session of Crime in Congress. So who's Mary Jo Kopechne? Mary Jo was born on July 26, 1940, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which is a city in Wyoming Valley of northeastern Pennsylvania, so about a 20-minute drive from Scranton for reference.
I think there's a really popular paper company in Scranton.
Yeah, I think there is. Isn't there a TV show about it?
Something like that,
Who's, you know, very vague memories. Her parents were homemaker Gwen and insurance salesman Joseph Kopechne. When Mary Jo was just 4 years old, the couple and their child, Mary Jo, moved to Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Compared to the Wyoming Valley, 1940s New Jersey was really a melting pot of different cultures, an environment that formed Mary Jo's world perspective and made her more empathetic to the plights of diverse groups of people for years to come. As a child, Mary Jo loved sports, especially baseball, and was an avid Dodgers fan. And her cousin, Georgetta Nelson, said that even as a kid, Mary Jo was confident and someone they looked up to and felt like they could really depend on to lead the way. Mary Jo grew up attending Catholic school and was a self-proclaimed cradle Catholic who fervently believed in her faith and regularly attended Mass. The same cousin I mentioned previously described Mary Jo as modest in speech, clothes, and action. And Mary Jo was also not one to drink more than one drink, maybe two on rare occasions. Just remember that. After graduating high school, Mary Jo attended Caldwell College for Women, where she got her BS in Business Administration. In school, Mary Jo served as VP of the business club for 2 years in a row, and she loved dancing and swimming and theater, a woman after my own heart. I'd also like to note that on her mother's side of the family, Mary Jo is the first to graduate high school and college, so she was killing it.
Sounds like Mary Jo was a really cool girl.
She gets even cooler. Right after graduating college, Mary Jo moved to Montgomery, Alabama to teach at St. Jude's High School. Now, this is 1962 Alabama, so we are smack in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement. This was just 1 year before Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested during anti-segregation protests and held in Birmingham Jail, where he penned his famous letter from Birmingham Jail. So this is Alabama we're talking about. And while living here, Mary Jo witnessed the struggle for justice and equality, which really ends up being pivotal to the rest of her career. And after a year of teaching in Alabama, Mary Jo set her sights on the nation's capital, where she thought she could make even a greater difference.
A trap many of us fall into. Just kidding. We do all make a difference. Congress is fun and very functional right now, right?
Yeah, exactly. I agree. Nothing wrong there. Granted, this is the 1960s, you know, meaning that legislation was supposedly getting passed.
What a novel concept.
Right. But anyways, Mary Jo's first gig on the Hill was in the office of Democratic Senator George A. Smathers from Florida. Not a lot of detail here, but Mary Jo told her family that she wasn't very in line with his politics. So it wasn't very long before Mary Jo moved jobs. And in 1965, she became a secretary in the office of Senator Robert F. Kennedy of New York.
Wait, JFK's brother?
That's the one. Most of our listeners probably already know this because we are all nerds from politics, I'm assuming, right? But RFK served as Attorney General during JFK's administration. And after JFK's assassination, Robert Kennedy left the Johnson administration when he was elected as U.S. Senator to New York. Now, before you ask, no, RFK was not a resident of New York. He was a resident of Massachusetts. And no, New York did not have a residency requirement for candidates for the U.S. Senate. But the people, regardless, love him and love the Kennedys, and RFK was elected to senator in 1964.
Is that still the case, the residency requirement stuff?
To my understanding, New York has a pretty lax residency rule standard in general. I think you only have to be a resident at the time of the election. Don't quote me on that, I'm not a lawyer. But kind of looking at a more recent example, Hillary Clinton, for example, moved to New York in September 1999 so she could run for Senate in the 2000 election. So in office, RFK continued his support for the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and also traveled the country, voicing his support for the civil rights movement. And Mary Jo loved her job in RFK's office. She really admired and believed in RFK's vision for America, especially when it came to his civil rights advocacy. And by all reports, she was a real hard worker and an absolute delight to be around in the office. She also grew pretty close to RFK. He even once gave a picture of her with her at the desk, and the note on the back of the picture said, "You work so hard, this is the only way I ever see you." When RFK announced his presidential candidacy in 1968, Mary Jo transitioned to working on his campaign. During his campaign, she worked as one of the quote-unquote boiler room girls, a name given to her and six other women who shared an office in this hot, loud, windowless location in Kennedy's Washington campaign headquarters. On the campaign, Mary Jo's job was to track down intelligence and compile data to try to figure out how the Democratic delegates would vote at the convention. But unfortunately, as we all know, RFK's bid for president ended when just a few months later, RFK was assassinated on June 5th, 1968. Naturally, Mary Jo was deeply upset by RFK's death, but, you know, money doesn't grow on trees, so she eventually picked herself up and went back to work. Between RFK's death and the fateful night at the Ted Kennedy cookout, Mary Jo worked for a time on a voter registration drive for Black voters in Florida, and then ended up working at a campaign consulting firm called Matt Reese Associates. That firm ran campaigns for Democrats around the nation. So in that job, it seemed like she moved around quite a bit on different campaigns. I won't name them all, but let me just say that this woman was shaking and moving. When the opportunity to reconnect with her boiler room friends in Martha's Vineyard came around, it sounded like a well-deserved reprieve. It's now Friday, July 18th, 1969, on Chappaquiddick Island. Now, Chappaquiddick Island is a peninsula and occasional island off the eastern end of, like, Martha's Vineyard. And in 1969, it was pretty sparsely inhabited. For this case, it's also important that you understand the four major roads on the island. I'm going to try to explain this the best I can, but I'll also link a map in the show notes that really lays it all out. So you have to think of the roads like a giant cross. The left side of the horizontal bar that goes down to the bottom half of the diagonal bar is one upside-down L-shaped road called Chappaquiddick Road. This road takes someone from the ferry landing down to the cottage where the cookout dinner party takes place. The ferry, by the way, is how you get to the mainland called Eggerstown. Okay, so the right side of the horizontal bar is called Dyke Road, and this is a dirt road that leads to Dyke Bridge where the beach is. So Dyke Bridge is this rickety old wooden bridge with no guardrails, remember that, where our crime scene is going to take place. And finally, the top side of the diagonal bar of the cross is the small road called Cemetery Road.
Let me make sure I understand, and this is a bit of an oversimplification, but there are two main roads that run perpendicular to one another. There's a small road that connects the two, which is Dyke Road, where our crime scene occurs.
Yeah, exactly. So we're back to Friday. Mary Jo is set to attend this cookout dinner party thrown in honor of former volunteers and staffers for RFK's campaign at this rented cottage in Chappaquiddick Island. In addition to RFK's other male advisors, Mary Jo and the rest of the boiler room girls, attendees were to include Ted Kennedy, RFK's younger brother, and at the time, Senator of Massachusetts. Ted was the youngest brother of JFK and RFK. So by 1969, at age 37, he had experienced the death of his three older brothers. Joe Jr., his eldest brother, died in a plane crash in World War II. His second oldest brother, President John F. Kennedy, was assassinated in 1963, riding in a convertible. And his third oldest brother, RFK Kennedy, had just been assassinated a year prior to that at his own campaign event in LA. I say all this because it's important to note that Ted Kennedy is now the eldest brother, and he's feeling the pressure from his family and the public to carry the torch of his older brothers and become president of the United States. I think this pressure to be president and also to avoid another Kennedy scandal plays a lot into his actions over the next 24 hours. Not an excuse, mind you. Just some context.
That is a lot to process, everything that you just laid out. It, again, doesn't excuse his actions, but I wouldn't be in a great headspace either if I were him.
Right, same. Now, Ted Kennedy, was in town to race in the Edgartown Regatta on the Kennedy's prized family sailboat. This event was a Friday-Saturday event, so Kennedy arrived at the mainland, remember, called Edgartown, on Friday at 1 p.m. Upon arriving, he was driven by his chauffeur and aide, John Crimmins, to the cottage on Chappaquiddick Island and then over Dyke Bridge to the beach to swim. After his swim, Kennedy is driven back over the bridge to the cottage and then back over to the mainland to sail in the race. After the race, Kennedy goes back to his hotel on the mainland called Shiretown Inn to get ready for the party. From the inn, he is then driven to the cottage for the party. This establishes that A, Kennedy had to be pretty familiar with the few roads that he traveled back and forth on, and B, Kennedy was not supposed to spend the night at the cottage. He had a hotel on the mainland. The same goes for Mary Jo. She and the other boiler room girls were to spend the night at another hotel on the mainland called the Katama Shores Motor Inn. Mary Jo arrived to the mainland Thursday night, and on Friday, she went on a separate outing with her girlfriends to the beach across the Dyke Bridge. Around 8:30 p.m. on the Friday, the whole group convenes at the small cottage to start the festivities. I mentioned the attendees before, but I also want to throw out some specific names that'll be important as this night continues. So the five men in attendance are Charles Treader, a Boston attorney, Ray LaRosa, a Massachusetts civil rights official, Jack Crimmins, Kennedy's chauffeur, who is also a legal aide and investigator, Paul Markham, a former United States attorney who worked on Ted's 1962 senatorial campaign, and Joseph Gargan, Kennedy's cousin and employee who really just kind of did whatever. Also worth noting, all the women attending the party were under 30 and all the men in attendance were over 30, most of them well over. And also none of the women were married and all but one of the men were married. The party is going well. Everyone's having a swell time, talking, eating, drinking, singing, dancing. There's alcohol at this party, mind you, but no one admits to having more than three drinks over the course of several hours. The two people who were to spend the night at the cottage were Crimmins and Markham, no one else. Everyone else was going back to the mainland to their hotels. And by the way, the last ferry ride was at midnight, but party guests were told that special arrangements could be made for a later trip if needed.
I mean, they were with the Kennedys.
Exactly. Now about 11:15 p.m., Kennedy goes over to his driver Crimmins and tells him that he's tired and that Mary Jo isn't feeling well. So can he have the keys to the car? And he was going to drop off Mary Jo at the hotel and then go back to his room. Crimmins gives him the keys and then Kennedy and Mary Jo leave. Also worth noting, he didn't tell anyone else this except Crimmins, his driver.
What did Mary Jo tell her friends?
Now Mary Jo, on the other hand, told no one at the party that she was leaving with Kennedy and left her pocketbook at the cottage. Also, on the mainland, Mary Jo was rooming with a fellow party attendee, Esther Newborough. So Esther had the key to their room, and Mary Jo did not ask for the room key upon her departure. I'd also like to note that while Kennedy and Mary Jo knew at least of each other for a number of years, with Kennedy even admitting that Mary Jo had been over to his house before, Kennedy was adamant that he never had a personal relationship with Mary Jo and that their ride that night was the first time the two had ever been alone.
It doesn't sound to me like Mary Jo was planning on going back to her hotel, but it's not completely unbelievable.
But to not tell anyone?
Not great behavior.
Right. So Mary Jo and Kennedy start down the road, and then Kennedy allegedly mistakes the road he's supposed to turn on and turns right onto Dyke Road instead of turning left to head towards the ferry landing. This is when disaster strikes. Kennedy, not expecting the bridge, loses control of the vehicle. The vehicle is going about 20 miles per hour. It flies through the air and hits the surface of the water, caving the roof inward and blowing out both windows on the passenger side, and also splintering the windshield.
He's claiming to have only had like three drinks over the course of the entire evening, right?
Yeah, two, maybe three. Kennedy managed to escape through an open window and reached the surface of the water, although his 6'2", 220-pound body was squeezed under the steering wheel and his movement was partially restricted by the plastic brace he wore around his middle since his near-fatal air crash in 1964.
Is this the same one that killed his brother?
No, his eldest brother died in World War II. But somehow, Mary Jo, who is a good swimmer with a much smaller frame, is not able to exit the vehicle through the open window or the windows that had been busted out in the crash.
Maybe the crash knocked her unconscious?
Maybe. But Candy later testified that Mary Jo was still conscious upon the crash and seemed to be almost fighting to be free of him.
Interesting wording there, free of him. I assume he tried everything he could to help her though, right?
In court, Candy testified that he made about 7 or 8 attempts to save Mary Jo, taking around 15 to 20 minutes total, but ultimately couldn't access the vehicle. He then swims ashore and sits there on the shore for another 15 to 20 minutes, catching his breath. Candy then walks back to the cottage, not noticing any lights or houses on his walk back, which is odd because we know there's at least one house on Dyke Road, and its inhabitants testified that they had their porch light on that night, at least until midnight. So maybe they had turned off the light by the time Kennedy made his walk back to the cottage. But regardless, there certainly was a house closer to the bridge that Kennedy could have knocked on before the cottage. So it's a 1.2 mile walk from the accident to the cottage. Kennedy guesses it took him about 15 minutes to walk back to the cottage, but investigators later did the walk themselves and said it took about 20 to 25 minutes to walk back. Either way, Kennedy makes his way back to the house around 12:20 a.m. Kennedy sees Ray La Rosa outside the cottage and asks him to get Joe Gargan, and then when Joe comes out, Candy tells him to get Paul Markham as well. The three, so Candy, Gargan, and Markham, then sit in the remaining car parked outside the cottage, where Candy tells them that a terrible accident just took place.
What an understatement. At this point, his car and a woman are under the water, and he doesn't seem to be acting with much urgency here.
This seems to be a trend. The three drive down to Dyke Bridge, where Gargan and Markham take off their clothes and they dive into the water to try to save Mary Jo. And they testify that they spend around 45 minutes trying to extract Mary Jo out of the car, and then Gargan and Markham, like Kennedy, are unsuccessful.
Timeline check. How long has Mary Jo been in the car now?
A little under 2 hours, and not one person has made a call to law enforcement. Instead, the three get back into the car and drive to the ferry landing to figure out their next moves. It's decided about after 10 minutes that Candy will go back to the mainland to report the accident, and that Gargan and Markham will go back to the cottage to make sure everyone stays calm. Without wanting to make special arrangements for a late-night ferry, Kennedy dives into the water and swims back to the mainland.
How far is that?
It's about 500 feet, so almost the length of 1.5 football fields. So not insanely far, but certainly far enough, especially with the current. Now, Gargan and Markham arrive back at the cottage around 2 a.m. and tell no one actually what happened. A New York Times article I read actually says that Gargan and Markham told everyone that they had been looking for a ferry, that Kennedy and Compeckney were at their respective motels, and that everything was fine, and to go to sleep. The woman at the party largely testified that Gargan and Markham looked and acted very normal upon coming back to the cottage. Kind of amazing for two men who had supposedly just spent 45 minutes fighting currents to save a woman trapped in a car. Meanwhile, Candy goes straight back to his hotel, changes out of his wet clothes, lays on the bed, and then redresses and goes outside to complain about a noise to the innkeeper and inquire the time. It's about 2:25 a.m. at that point. Candy goes back to his room and remains there until 7:30 a.m.
You know what it's not giving? Remorse.
Yeah, and it kind of gets worse. At 7:30 a.m., Kennedy emerges from his room and then shoots the shit with a sailing buddy of his for about a half an hour before Gargan and Markham show up to the hotel. Kennedy tells them that he has not reported the accident, but that he wanted to make a private call. So the three drive over to Chappaquiddick Island again, where Kennedy uses the public phone off the ferry landing to call his attorney, David Burke, but Burke doesn't answer. The three then hear from a ferry worker that a car has been discovered over by the Dyke Bridge.
I don't like that his first call was to an attorney.
Me either. So once I find out that the car's been found, Gargan goes back to the cottage to tell the others about the accident that happened, and Markham and Kennedy finally head to the police station to report the accident at approximately 10 a.m., almost 12 hours after the accident. And Kennedy states that he was the driver of the vehicle and dictates a statement about the accident, but does not sign the report. Now, while Kennedy was chit-chatting with his buddies and delaying going to the police station on that Saturday morning, the police are informed of a submerged car off Dyke's Bridge at 8:20 a.m. Eggerstown Police Chief Dominic James Arena reports the scene. After making efforts of his own to access the vehicle, Arena calls John Farrer, captain of the Edgartown Fire Rescue Unit, who arrived at 8:45 a.m. Equipped with scuba gear, Farrer is able to discover Mary Jo's body in the back seat and remove her quickly. At 9:15 a.m., Associate Medical Examiner Donald Mills arrives and declares that Mary Jo has died from accidental drowning. He sees no signs of foul play and does not order an autopsy. This decision was also advised by the DA's office, supposedly.
There might be an innocent explanation here. This man was an expert with equipment, but I find it notable that he was able to remove her easily. Makes me question the rescue efforts that were done beforehand.
Right. It's also worth noting that Mills was not the head medical examiner at the time, and instead was filling in for medical examiner Robert Nevin. Nevin later relayed that he disagreed with the decision not to do an autopsy. I will also say that even though her official cause of death was noted as accidental drowning, the undertaker, Gene Fry, I think that's how you pronounce his name? Anyways, Gene, he told reporters that Mary Jo's death was due to suffocation rather than drowning. He said this because, and this is kind of graphic, so feel free to skip ahead like 30 seconds if you don't want to hear. But Gene was looking over Dr. Mills' shoulder when he manipulated Mary Jo's body at the scene of the crime, and Mary Jo's body produced some water flow, water, and foam, but mostly foam. And the undertaker said that he expected more water from a drowning victim. And John Farrer, the diver who removed Mary Jo from the car, he also claimed that she was too buoyant to be full of water. Also to that point, Fry reported that Mary Jo was found with her hands clasping the back seat and her face turned upwards towards where an air pocket in the car would have formed. This all indicates that, again, Mary Jo died of suffocation, not drowning. In fact, Farr testified that it would have taken at least 2 hours for Mary Jo to die in the case of suffocation, and that he was by Mary Jo's side within 25 minutes of getting the call from police.
That is awful.
There was also a blood stain on Mary Jo's blouse, and Dr. Mills directed that blood sample to be sent to the state police for analysis for blood alcohol content. That analysis found that Mary Jo's blood alcohol content was 0.09%. which indicates that Mary Jo could have had up to 5 drinks of liquor within an hour prior to her death. That goes based on like height and weight. And I say all that not to slander Mary Jo in any way. I say that just because it seems like folks at the party were having a lot more than 2 drinks. But in terms of forensics, that's all the police do. And by Sunday, Mary Jo's body was embalmed and flown to Pennsylvania to her family for burial. She was just 28 years old when she died.
That's tragic. Now, what happened to Ted?
7 days after the accident, on July 25th, 1969, Ted Kennedy pled guilty to a charge of leaving the scene of the crime of an accident causing bodily injury before Massachusetts District Court Judge James Boyle. The judge sentenced Kennedy to the statutory minimum of 2 months in prison, but suspended that sentence citing Kennedy's quote-unquote unblemished record and saying that Kennedy quote-unquote has already been and will continue to be punished far beyond anything that this court could impose. Now, Kennedy did have some reckless driving and other traffic violation charges in his past, so unblemished is certainly not the right word to describe Kennedy's record. But despite this, Kennedy essentially gets off scot-free.
And it's unblemished except for, you know, this. I'm shocked he didn't at least land himself a manslaughter charge, but I guess that's the benefit of being a Kennedy.
After his arraignment, Kennedy does this public address on TV in which he tries to explain to his voters and the public what happened and why he was so delayed in calling the police. Let me just say, it leaves a lot of unanswered questions. Essentially, Kennedy says that he was flooded with a jumble of emotions, grief, fear, doubt, exhaustion, panic, confusion, shock. And that part of his mind thought that Mary Jo was still alive in the car or the remaining area. And it's not a good excuse. And then he asked his voters for their advice and prayers on whether or not he should resign. The day that Kennedy returns to his Senate seat, on July 31st, 1969, District Attorney Edmund Dennis started the process of asking for a judicial inquest into Mary Jo's death, a request which he is granted.
Remind me, what's an inquest?
Yeah. In Massachusetts, an inquest is a procedure in which a judge investigates the circumstances of a death and determines whether it resulted from any crime. Before we dive into the inquest, I want to point out that D.A. Dennis does request for the exhumation of Mary Jo's body in September 1969, saying that the blood sample I mentioned earlier could maybe not be consistent with drowning. Mary Jo's parents, for the record, did not want Mary Jo exhumed, and the judge in that case ultimately denied the request, stating that there was not enough evidence to say that Mary Jo died from something other than drowning. The inquest finally begins in January 1970. Due to efforts by Kennedy's legal team, the inquest was delayed for several months and was ordered to be performed secretly and not open to the press. Interestingly, the judge who presided over this inquest was the same judge, James Boyles, who sentenced Kennedy and was extraordinarily lenient.
Come on, isn't that a conflict of interest?
I thought the same thing, but I guess not, because no one really makes a big stink about it from what I found. The timeline and the content that I've presented thus far largely comes from the inquest, where Kennedy, amongst many others, testified. But a couple of interesting tidbits that I haven't mentioned are also revealed in the inquest. First, we have the testimony of Christopher Look Jr., who was a deputy sheriff living on Chappaquiddick Island at the time of the incident. On his way home, approximately at 12:45 a.m. on July 19th, he reported seeing a dark-colored vehicle with registration plates starting with L7 and ending with 7. Look was heading down Chappaquiddick Road, and he watched this dark-colored car cross in front of him at the junction of Chappaquiddick Road, Dyke Road, and Cemetery Road. The car drives straight onto Cemetery Road and then stops, backs up, and goes back down Dyke Road towards the bridge. Look also reported seeing two people in the front seat and a shadow in the back seat that could have been a person or could have been a bag.
It's obviously interesting that the car switched directions, but I also find that time really significant. Didn't you say earlier that he got home around, or not home, but to the cottage around 12:20 a.m.?
Sure I did.
But it seems to me like this officer would have a better idea of the exact timing of events than someone who was drunk and in a traumatic accident.
That's kind of my thought too. And interestingly enough, Kennedy's car that he drove off the bridge was also a dark-colored car with a license plate of L78207. Now let's do a quick timeline check. Kennedy testified that he left with Mary Jo around 11:15 p.m. in his car with the license plate of L78207. And Look reports seeing this dark-colored vehicle at 12:45 a.m. So this totally messes up Kennedy's timeline.
What color was the other car the three rode into the scene of the crime? Could it have been that car?
So, great question. That car was white. So, if Chris's testimony is accurate, it indicates that Kennedy and Mary Jo left the party over an hour later than Kennedy testified. However, inhabitants of the house I mentioned earlier, that the house that stood close to the bridge, they reported that they heard a car sometime around midnight. Also, on the subject of timeline, the girl that Mary Jo was rooming with, Esther, said in an interview shortly after the incident that she didn't know what time Kennedy and Mary Jo left because no one was really checking the time. But then 6 months later at the inquest, Esther changed her story completely and was adamant that Mary Jo and Kennedy left the party at 11:30 a.m. During the inquest, Kennedy again says he fully intended to report the accident as soon as he reached the mainland, but he was in shock, and he also had this notion that Gargan and Markham were going to come over to his place in the morning and say that Mary Jo was alive and well and back at the cottage. Which could have likely been the case if he had called the police. But going back to Mary Jo's official cause of death, remember, the request to exhume her body was denied, and Judge Boyle also stated in his final inquest report that there was not enough evidence to show that any air pocket remained in the car, so testimony was not sought out to figure out how long Mary Jo might have remained alive in the vehicle. Also going back to the topic of blood alcohol content, Crimmins, remember this is Kennedy's aide and driver, said that he stocked the cottage with 3 half-gallons of vodka, 4/5 of scotch, 2 bottles of rum, and a couple cases of beer. After the party, Crimmins said they took away 2 bottles of vodka, 3 bottles of scotch, and the beer, which, if we do the math, leaves 1/2 gallon of vodka, 1/5 of scotch, and bottles of rum unaccounted for. And again, everyone had testified said that they had at most 3 drinks. And also, if you really look down in their testimonies and, you know, basically them saying who drank what, it just doesn't add up.
Yeah, I'm not one to judge here, but definitely contributes to a foggy timeline.
In the end, Judge Boyle says in his final inquest report dated February 18, 1970, that he inferred, based on the evidence, that Mary Jo and Kennedy had no intention of leaving to go to the mainland when they left the cottage together. He also infers that Kennedy's turn on Dyke Road that night was intentional and not a mistake. This was further supported by the fact that there was a left turn sign with an arrow made of reflecting glass at the junction at Chappaquiddick and Dyke Road, and the fact that the asphalt road also banked slightly to the left to help swing a car in the direction towards the ferry on Chappaquiddick Road. Candy also stated in his testimony that he had noticed that he was driving on a dirt road, which would be Dyke Road, but that there was no place to turn around, which, according to investigators, is not the case, and there are several driveways that Candy could have turned around in if needed. Not to mention that, like, according to Look's testimony, Candy literally stopped his car in the middle of Cemetery Road to redirect his course, so obviously having a place to turn around does not seem to be an issue for Kennedy. To whether Kennedy committed a crime while operating the vehicle, the judge reported that due to his recent outings back and forth from the beach, Kennedy would have known that driving across the bridge required proper caution that Kennedy did not employ. For example, Kennedy admitted to going over 20 miles an hour on the bridge. Therefore, Judge Boyle found probable cause to believe that Kennedy, quote-unquote, operated his motor vehicle negligently, and that such an operation appears to have contributed to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne.
What does that mean for Kennedy?
So, finding probable cause, Judge Boyle could have put out a warrant for Kennedy's arrest. This is something that he does not do. And, despite Judge Boyle's finding, D.A. Dennis chose not to prosecute Kennedy for manslaughter and later told a grand jury that there was not enough evidence to indict Kennedy on potential charges of manslaughter, perjury, or driving to endanger. That grand jury I just mentioned was held in Dukes County in April 1970, so months after the inquest, where Eggerstown is located. Remember, Kennedy's sentence and the following inquest was held in district court. The county judge in Dukes County said that the jury could not see the evidence presented in the inquest as the report from the private proceedings were still held in district court. In the end, the grand jury called four witnesses who had not testified at the inquest, but no indictments were ultimately issued. Ted Kennedy went on to easily win re-election to the Senate in November of 1970 with 62% of the vote against Republican candidate Josiah Spaulding. He remained Massachusetts senator until August 25, 2009, at his death at age 77. He is ranked 5th in U.S. history for length of continuous service as a senator.
Pretty much no repercussions then for, even if it was an accident, his completely negligent behavior following the crime.
Right. The only kind of repercussion is that the Chappaquiddick incident does at least dash Kennedy's prospects of becoming president. An article from Time magazine say that the scandal contributed to Kennedy's decisions not to run for president in 1972, 1976, and 1984. A 1972 Time article also deduced that Kennedy couldn't carry the Midwest because of the question of what a married man was doing in a car with a single woman in the first place. And when Kennedy did run for president in 1980, there were bumper stickers that read, "Nobody drowned at Watergate." And Jimmy Carter made a dig at Kennedy saying that he had never panicked in a crisis, which many thought was a reference to Kennedy's actions following the accident.
What about her parents? That must have been really hard to see Kennedy go on and have such a successful career.
As for Mary Jo's family, her parents stopped talking about Mary Jo to the press and became more private. Her father, Joe, lived to see his 90th birthday. He died December 2003, and her mother, Gwen, died January 2008 at age 89. Both her parents relayed that they had ultimately found peace with their daughter's death, knowing that Mary Jo was in heaven and that Mary Jo died having realized her dream of working in Washington, D.C. on issues that mattered to her. Mary Jo's cousin, Georgetta, did not address the Chappaquiddick incident in her book called Our Mary Jo, which is where I got most of the information about Mary Jo's life. In deciding to leave out the Chappaquiddick incident, she said, and I think this is a beautiful quote, "Mary Jo owed Chappaquiddick nothing. Chappaquiddick was never about Mary Jo anyways. It just happened to be where she died."
I think it's always important to focus on victims' lives because that was where they actually got to make choices, and they should be defined by their choices that they made and not the choices that were made for them.
Absolutely. And that is the case of the Chappaquiddick incident. Harley, want to gavel us out?